difficult if you hang on to it. Only difficult if you attach to it. If you want to understand it.
You let go, it's okay. It is what it is.
Okay. So, sorry?
It's very paradoxical in many ways.
It is. And Zen is very paradoxical. Thank you for that. It's very paradoxical. Yes. Okay, we can't solve the paradox through intellectual grappling or speech and words. We can only solve the paradox through the practice path of direct experience. So, He Neng, the sixth patriarch, and I just have to move for a minute because I have a knee which presents some problems at this stage of my life. I'm just going to. You want to stand and stretch for a minute? Just take a minute.
Let's do some touch.
Yeah?
I like to swim, sleep. I'll just sit here.
So these days I can't actually go into the pool practice of the meditation halls because I've passed the age date and the body age date when I can manage that very demanding physical practice. So most people in the Korean meditation halls who go for many years into that practice have left that very similar practice in their 50s.
Wow.
And still continue to practice, of course, but if you go into the meditation halls and you make a commitment to a season, a three-month period, then it's unconditional. You can't decide to have a sleep in one morning or miss a session, or if you get sick, you leave. So you do. It's all or nothing. So as our bodies, as the Buddha taught us, start to age and get sick, we'll find that that style of practice far too demanding. But by that time, hopefully, we've got a little bit more practice wisdom so that we don't actually have to push ourselves in that way. We find a practice that's more natural to us, and by that time, we found a practice which is really, to some extent, our own way of practice, and that practice continues in our lives, whether we're sitting on the cushion or whatever we're doing.
You're no longer attached to that practice.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, that's the idea anyway.
So, Sunim, okay. If anyone was going to join that kind of three-month practice session,
yes,
would there be any instructions given to people? Or do they just go in and sit and look at the wall and hope for
that? We do have a Dharma talk three-month period. Mm-hmm. And there is the International Monastery in Korea, Musangsa, actually offers an opportunity for people to come into that three-month practice, a little bit different from the very traditional practice meditation halls, where the monastics practice alone. But there's a growing trend now in Korea to open up some practice opportunities for people. So you can go to this monastery, which is very traditional monastery in lots of ways. The language, common language, is English, and you can, as long as you make a commitment for 2 weeks minimum, then you can join in that meditation season. And you'll be given a little bit of instruction, basically, about how to sit and how to follow the daily life path, which includes all of the actions from the moment of waking up in the morning to going to sleep at night. And those actions are directed in a non-speech way by certain things. So this, for example, is used in the meditation halls, and of course historically, this one and a longer stick or so, they feature in a lot of the old stories in the Zen tradition of, you know, being hit 100 times and beaten, or we don't really use it in that way. But we do use it in the meditation halls, and we use it during the practice sessions as a way of relieving tension in the body. So if you're sitting for those periods, then you'll find that you'll get, you know, quite tense and quite knotted in the body. So there's a much longer stick that we use, and the person who's actually being appointed for that season as the head monk will carry this stick and will just walk around the back of the practitioners, and we will indicate that we actually want to be struck. So there's a particular way of doing that. So the positions and the places where we accrue a lot of that pool of build-up in the muscle is, you know, the shoulder blades, and also here on the top of the shoulder blades, behind the shoulder blades.
You give the person
the massage.
And so,
how hard do you eat it?
This one isn't really the correct stick, but I'll just it's a one flat stick, and it's a lot longer, but it's sort of...
That's quite gentle.
Can you feel that?
Yeah, absolutely.
That should be like a massage.
Much harder.
It's okay. It's
nothing. So if you've got a build-up of tension there,
what
do you call it in the muscle?
A knot. Mm. A knot.
Like a knot.
A knot, but also there's a fluid, I can't remember what it's called. Synovial fluid, I can't remember. Anyway, so that breaks it up, and so you get immediate relief from it.
Mm.
And the flow comes back into your body mind. So that's what we do. But we also use this, so when we come into the Dharma Hall, we stand behind our cushion, and we wait until we hear the signal to sit.
Mm-hmm.
And before we sit, we bow to the cushion, and we sit. And then we sit and wait, and then we do this three times, which indicates the beginning of the sitting session.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have three, we usually sit for 3 hours at a time, but we sit for 55 minutes, and then we stand and do some walking meditation for 5 minutes, and then sit again for another 55 minutes. So after the 55 minutes, you hear that again, and that indicates to stand. So this is used constantly in the meditation halls as a way of, you know, just instructing us what we need to do now. So we don't have to think too much. It's a very wonderful thing, really. And we use bells, we also use another instrument called a moktuk, which is a wooden instrument that we strike with I should have brought it along to show you, but
we may have one.
So that's what we use actually to accompany chanting.
Have one of these?
It's a very big one.
Got a smaller?
Have you got a smaller?
No.
So we use a smaller one of those. So all of these instruments or devices are used we become familiar with this one means this and that one means that, and so we don't have to think. We just hear the sound. That sound is quite different from the moktuk or from the big bell, and we know. Okay, so we need to go there, and we need to sit, or we need to stand, or we need to, in the formal meal, we need to open up our bowls and set them out for the meal, whatever it is. And there's a great freedom in that. Yeah, great freedom. Because, you know, we can give ourselves completely to the practice.
Mm.
And some people say, how can you be in that environment? You know, like that's such a harsh way of being. And I say, it's a very great freedom.
Mm.
I don't have to make any decisions. I don't have to have any ideas about what I should be doing in this moment. I don't have to look after anyone else. I'm here solely to give myself 100% to my practice. And I mean, that's such a wonderful opportunity. And as I was saying, you can do this in career if you want. You can apply to join a retreat situation. So the initial instructions would be generally quite simple and very brief about posture, and also in the Zen tradition we have the focus for breathing at the point that we call in Japanese the hara, which is just below the navel. And this point, of course, is used in And so in Zen we understand this point as being where the thinking mind disappears, where the thinking mind arises. Mm. This is a point that we associate with emptiness.
Mm.
So emptiness, of course, is not empty. Is it? Is it empty?
Say anything. That's too dualistic.
We talk about emptiness, but it's not a void. It's a flow again. So emptiness is a coming. It's also a coming into being, and a coming into being and a passing away. So we associate this point with that. Things arise and things disappear.
Yeah.
Thoughts, feelings, sensations, ideas, etc. And so that's why we focus on this point. It helps us to really focus the mind in this single point of concentration. And so you get instruction about that. You also get some instruction about breath. What else do you get instruction about? Posture. Some simple things like, how to wear the robes.
Okay.
And also we do a formal meal during the retreat time. So there's a whole instruction about, how you behave at that formal meal and, setting out the bowls and cleaning the bowls and putting the bowls together, all these sorts of things. Those very practical things. But you won't get instruction about how to meditate. And you can't really. Instruction about how to meditate is really an oxymoron. Because, that's what you are.
So did anyone get enlightened through the practice?
Through the practice?
Yes, through the harsh practice.
Many
got enlightened.
Many. Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. There's in the Korean lineage and in the Chan lineage, Chinese. I mean, the Japanese are many enlightened masters, and my teacher actually was an enlightened master, Zen Master Songtsang. So he was one of many in the Zen tradition. He's the 78th patriarch in the Rinzai lineage of Zen. So there are two lineages of Zen. One is the Soto lineage, Soto Zen, you say. That's the Zen that has really took root in Korea. And you may have heard of Dogen, who was the founder of at the Sutra Zen, and he actually went to China and he practiced with the Chagong Chan Master in China, and he attained enlightenment in China with that practice that this 13th patriarch, Chan patriarch in China, he taught him how to the form of Shikantaza. And Shikantaza is a Soto Zen orientation where you don't use any particular focus, it's just bare awareness. So you just sit. You don't use a mantra, you don't use a breath technique, you don't use anything, you just sit. And abiding nowhere, holding nothing. this is the method of the Soto Zen. Rinzai Zen, which is the original Chan practice lineage, which comes from Linchi. Has anyone heard of Linchi? Yeah. So Linchi was the first patriarch of the Rinzai tradition. Rinzai is a Japanese word from Linchi. So the Rinzai tradition, we do use koans as part of the practice, and we do use this orientation to the tangent, or in English we say the rule center. And we do at times, sometimes we may also use a mantra. So we will use it sometimes focus for our attention, but in the Soto Zen they don't. All Zen practitioners, as I said before, we practice open-eyed meditation, and basically that means that we let our eyes half close, and we focus on somewhere on the floor. Probably about a metre in front of us, and that's our where we put our gaze. And we do that because it keeps our attention alert. So if you meditated, and you'll know, especially when you're in the early stages of meditating, it's very easy to kind of nod off or into a half state of dream or which means that you're not really here, you're not here in this moment, you're not present in this moment. So in Korea, all of the meditation halls, in Korea we have this underfloor heating. So all of the meditation halls are heated. And in fact, in the temple that I live in presently, we have also this underfloor heating, which is very wonderful. And all of the floors are covered in this yellow lino, all the same. So we say in the practice, if you can't see floor is yellow, then where's your mind? So how do we know we're present? Floor is yellow. Okay, we're actually coming close to ending now, and I actually just want to finish with just together perhaps reading the Heart Sutra. Now this sutra, do you know the Heart Sutra? Okay, so this is a really core teaching and practice in the Zen tradition, and this sutra talks about how everything is empty of particularity, inherently empty, and this points to the truth of interconnectedness, of how there is not this and that, how there is not you and me, how there is not inside, outside, that we are all part of you, all part of this one, this totality, this interconnectedness that Thich Nhat Hanh calls interbeing, interbeingness. So this sutra, the Heart Sutra, the teaching that points to this, tells us that what we think of as I, me, this name, this form, feelings, sensations, consciousness, are empty, empty of particularity. And when we can understand this, we attain the wisdom of sunyata, of emptiness. Okay, so let's do this together, just to finish up. I'm going to give the signal with the...
Okay.
The Maha, I'll just speak it. The Maha, Prajna Paramita Hidaya Sutra. Prajna means wisdom, Paramita means crossing over to the other shore, and Hidaya Sutra is the core sutra. So the Heart Sutra is actually the core of a great collection of wisdom sutras called the Prajna Paramita Sutra. It's the shortest sutra in the Buddhist teaching, and it is the most profound of all the teachings. So in this sutra, Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva, who is the being of compassion, and you will have heard of Avalokiteshvara, I'm sure, if you will come to the Mahayana teachings. So Avalokiteshvara is really very central to the Mahayana of the Bodhisattva path. So Avalokiteshvara is actually taking time to instruct Shariputra. Now Shariputra is one of the principal disciples of the Buddha, and it is said that Shariputra has already realized the truth of himself. So he's already what we call in Theravada Arahantship. But Avalokiteshvara is saying to Sariputra, but that's not the end, Ajahn. That's not the end. So you understand that self is empty. But what I'm going to instruct you about is how everything, all things, the whole of the Dharma is empty. Empty of particularity, empty of inherent nature. So he says to Shariputra, we start the context for an Avalokiteshvara, while practicing deeply the Prajna Paramita, while practicing deeply the wisdom that will take him to the other shore of enlightenment, to cross over, perceives that all five skandhas are empty. And five skandhas are the description that we use for what we think of as a human being. And the five skandhas are name and form, sensations, feelings, consciousness, and one more that I've overlooked.
Perception.
So these are we talk about them as five heaps that together condition me. We think of as me or a human being. So Avalokiteshvara is saying that all of these five skandhas, so essentially what we think of as a human being, as me, are empty. And in understanding this, we are saved from all suffering and distress. So then he goes on to say, Shariputra, that's the Arahant's name, form is not different from emptiness. So he's saying that that emptiness is not just empty. Emptiness is also form. Form is emptiness. Two sides of the one coin. So here we start to get this sense of flow, how everything is in flow. Emptiness is not different from form. that which is form is emptiness, and that which is emptiness is form. The same is true for feelings, perceptions, impulses, consciousness. But all these too are empty, but not different from form. So do you want to say it together? We'll do it together. Enough explanation. Let's just speak. Let's just start from Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva. While practicing deeply the Prajnaparamita, perceives that all five skandhas are empty, and is thus saved from all suffering and distress. Sariputra, form is not different from emptiness, and emptiness is not different from form. That which is form is emptiness, and that which is emptiness is form. The same is true of feelings, perceptions, impulses, consciousness. Sariputra, all dharmas are marked with emptiness. They do not appear or disappear. They are not tainted or pure. Nor do they increase or decrease. Therefore, in emptiness, there is no form, no feelings, perceptions, impulses, or consciousness. No eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. No colour, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch, no object of mind, no realm of eyes, and so forth until no realm of mind consciousness, no ignorance and also no extinction of it, and so forth until no old age and death, and also no extinction of them, no suffering, no agitation, no stopping, no power, no cognition, also no attainment and nothing to attain. The Bodhisattva depends on Prajnaparamita, and the mind is no ignorance. Without any ignorance, no fears exist. Far away from every perverted view, one dwells in Nirvana. In the three worlds, all Buddhas depend on Prajnaparamita and attain Anuttara Sanyasambuddhi. Therefore, know that Prajnaparamita is the great transcendent mantra, the great bright mantra, is the utmost supreme mantra. Which is able to relieve all suffering and is true, not false. So proclaim the Prajnaparamita mantra. Proclaim the mantra which says, Gate Gate Parasangate Parasangate Bodhisattva Gate Gate Paragate Parasangate Bodhisattva Gate Gate Paragate Parasangate Bodhisattva Gate, gate, paragate, gone, gone, parasangate, gone beyond, Bodhisattva. Wonderful.
Wonderful, thank you.
Gone to the other shore, no more suffering. So that Heart Sutra is another day of teaching. But you know, with the Heart Sutra, we recite this in a formal context. Three times a day, or three times we come together to chant sutras in the temple, and every day, and it's how many years, it's still the depth of it is profound. So just even reciting it without trying to understand it, it will have some liberating effect on mind if you have the inclination to do so. So I leave you with that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sir.
Thank you.
I also just want to just extend an apology to you if I've caused any confusion or suffering in your mind, not being able to understand. So this is why we don't actually talk very much about Zen in a descriptive explanation sense. So I offer my deep apology.
Can we ask a question?
Yes, of course. Yes.
So I'm wondering, you talked about a thing, a tradition of sudden enlightenment.
Yeah. So do you want to sit down again? Yeah. Just for a minute. Yeah?
No. Just to use a more everyday example, a therapist recognizes they're not going to help the client if they give them all the answers.
Yes.
They recognize that the client needs to come to their own realization.
That's a very wise therapist.
And so if the client comes to the realization of how, in what ways their thinking has really created the problem and has the ability to then think differently, that profound realization will create a major transformation in their life.
Absolutely.
So in the same way, one could talk about having a profound realization and awakening and enlightenment experience. But in my own limited conception, it would seem that that's a profound realization can create a major transformation, but that's not the same as full enlightenment. And so I kind of wonder this idea of a binary, no enlightenment, sudden enlightenment.
Yes. Good question.
It seems a little, I don't know.
Yes. So what I'm introducing to you today is really, you know, the historical and formative kind of ways of the tradition, but again, don't attach to them. So, a sudden enlightenment is an idea. Who knows, except to have become enlightened oneself, who knows what enlightenment is? And in having become enlightened, or realized enlightenment in a sense, how do you express that to anyone else? And once you put it into speech and words, it already becomes problematic. So when we talk about sudden enlightenment, it's a very clumsy and crude and, you know, not helpful for some people, way of pointing towards, you know, a profound realization that we can't use speech and words to communicate. You talked about an enlightened experience, and I think that's really the key, perhaps to understanding, is if you're a practitioner, then you know you have along the way, many experiences, and as you gave the example of a therapist, some of those experiences will be, you know, deeply transforming. And, you know, they may last, in the sense of a deep experience, perhaps a very true experience of sunyata, of emptiness. It may, if you really deeply experience that, realize that, it may stay with you for a day, a month, a year. But if it then leaves, then it's an experience. It's only an experience. Now, some of these experiences are wonderful because, you know, they encourage us to keep practicing. They, as you say, can transform lives. So we don't, you know, we don't dismiss them, but it's really important in the way of a practice is not to attach to them, to know that what the path of enlightenment, you know, why we practice is, you know, to go beyond life and death. So to transcend the conditioned eventuality of death and rebirth. That doesn't mean that we don't return, but it means that we're not, you know, we don't experience the conditioned death and rebirth that is part of the samsaric wheel of suffering. So experiences, you know, the and that's why with someone who in the Zen path, you know, one can't just have an experience and then go around saying, well, I'm enlightened. Do, but if you're in a situation where you've got a teacher, someone, a wise teacher, they probably hit you over the head. So there's a whole form of testing someone's enlightenment, and those who can test enlightenment are those who've already been verified to have enlightenment.
So what are some of the tests?
Sorry?
What are some of the
tests? I don't know, because I haven't actually sought to be tested. I'm pretty sure I wouldn't pass the test, so I haven't. I think that would be very embarrassing. basically, it's using, again, going back to the koans, or the koans as we call them in Korean, and so there are particular, each teacher will use a combination of koans to test the person's mind, to to be able to see whether they have really fully and totally realized, broken through, awakened in a sense. And that's a very formal process. So you actually have to have three different Zen masters. You have to get the tick from three of them. And then, you know, in the case of my own teacher, who he was enlightened in his 20s, and he sought verification of that. And then of the three, there was one Zen master that he felt an affinity with to stay with. And that Zen master instructed him then to keep silence for 3 years. So even though he had, he'd been, there'd been some recognition really of his awakening, still he was instructed to keep silent in a way of allowing that to deeply penetrate. Yeah. So for 3 years he kept silence. And so we talk about in our tradition sudden enlightenment, sudden awakening, gradual enlightenment. So the sudden awakening is in that fullness of opening, of awakening, 360-degree mind awakening, opening. But then the gradual enlightenment is in the following period of, it's like, the wine, the grapes sit in the mature in that way. So it doesn't mean, as I said before, that everything that we, that I practiced before, that has no, value or no, but it's, and again, it's really, when you boil it down, it's just, it's an idea. And And if it speaks to you, and it may not speak to you now, but some time on that practice journey, it, you know, it may actually have much more meaning and significance to you. So these things are very hard to, again, to understand with this conditioned mind. It's like they're moments of aha when we go through, and you know, we go along continuing practice, and then something that we've heard 100,000 times before, you know, suddenly we hear it again, and it's like, oh, that's what it is. That's what it is. And I can remember that happening on one occasion for me with my teacher, where he was talking about suchness, atatata, which is, you know, only this, just this, whatever's happening right now. And you know, I would have heard him say that 100,000 times in many different ways. But on this one occasion, you know, he spoke it again, and it was like it just and finally I got it in some way. but there was, you know, a deeper mind and understanding and a little bit of wisdom with it, you know. So in fact for me it was a very interesting thing because, you know, I guess I'd spent a lot of years, as many Westerners do, spiritual seekers, going here and going there and looking for teachers and looking to get it and looking for someone to give it to me, and you know. And finally, with that, you know, that particular encounter, what the aha for me was, I don't need to go anywhere anymore. And that didn't mean necessarily just to stay with that teacher. What it meant was, you know, this moment is where it is. So wherever I am, that's where I need to be. That's where I am. And that's where I need to be. And so rather than actually, you know, pulling out this idea that I should be somewhere else or maybe over there is better, well, this teacher, oh, that's the new one, let's try that one. It was like, it was such a relief in me, a really deep relief in me, that I don't have to do that anymore. Mm. So that aha moment was really triggered by that, you know, that particular context of considering talking about again this idea of suchness, or you know, just being where you are in a sense. So it's just a very small example. So you know, there's been some small, but I'm pretty sure that I haven't arrived. And that's okay. I don't have it. You know, I suppose in the years when you're young and you're really pushing it, you know, and you know, I think I used to think that I'd arrive and then I'd be able to spend the rest of my days lying on the banana lounge and basking in the sun and not having to worry about it all. But of course, the further you go along the journey, the more you realise that there is no end to it, really. You know, and we talk about, having arrived in the sense of realisation, but really that is just the beginning in itself too.
I'm assuming that your master would feel that he is continually growing.
Of course, of course, yes. And you know, and His Holiness the Dalai Lama, I mean, he speaks about the path of enlightenment in Kalpas. You know, and Kalpa is a very, very, very long time. So, you know, he doesn't beat around the bush. So when we talk about enlightenment, we have to try and understand what that means, what that word means in the context of the practice tradition that it's referring to. Mm. And it can't, you know, it's not necessarily transferable, it's not necessarily an absolute kind of, you know, the word itself cannot contain all of the all of the different practice understandings of that. Mm.
Well, often people see it as an exit strategy, right? So like an exit strategy. It's when they feel that samsara is filled with so much suffering and we want to get out of this samsara and so we want to reach enlightenment, get that out of the way and then we'll be in pure bliss forever, right? But it's really heartwarming coming to the Zen tradition because then what we're able to see is actually there is no going anywhere. Nibbana is not a place. It's not outside of this moment.
That's right. That's right. It's in every moment. It's possible in every moment. And so when we talk about being free of suffering, you know, in every moment that's a possibility. And it doesn't mean that in the next moment it will carry over, but that's up to us. It is. It's here and now.
One other thing I was kind of thinking as you talked about this, being tested for it, is
being
tested for enlightenment.
Oh, yeah.
Does an enlightened person seek to have the enlightenment?
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. They have to do. They have to seek it themselves. Otherwise, it's not someone, they're not roaming.
No, I get that, but I mean, some people would argue when you're enlightened, you wouldn't bother about seeking other people to say, oh, yes, you're enlightened.
But I suppose, again, it's part of a practice tradition. So it only really makes sense within that practice tradition. And the thing is, if you come into the presence of someone who has some degree of, a realization, a reasonably high level of practice, realization, then, and you do that in a way of opening and humility, then you will experience that very directly. So it's not something that that we can't know. But the Buddha encourages people not really to talk about their special dharma achievements, and if an enlightened person is kind of making a point of letting you know that they're enlightened, then be a little bit wary. this practice in the Zen tradition of seeking to have your enlightenment confirmed is a very, very secret private practice. It doesn't happen in the community at large, although it may happen later at some stage that the spiritual master of my order, he may at some stage make some sort of obtuse reference to someone, having realized something that was quite significant, and he may do that by conferring a particular name to them, which points to something of their realization. But it's not something that's talked about in in Korea we know, and certainly we don't know. I mean, I'm sure there are, as I said to the head monk where I am now the other day, I said, I think it's interesting that there's never been a bhikkhuni, a woman Zen master recognized in the Son lineage in Korea. For me that doesn't indicate that there's no woman practitioners who haven't achieved something fairly substantial in their practice. But of course, we operate within a culture and a social conditioning where men are recognised and monks are recognised and know, that's how it is. And I'm sure there are a lot, you know, now, I mean, there are many people out in the world, and we, you know, we could probably, you know, without too much effort, you know, in our own mind, name two or three that we might think, you know, do have a very deep spiritual realization, and they're not necessarily Buddhists, and they're not necessarily Zen practitioners. You know, it's not something that's confined to Buddhists or to Zen practitioners. I mean, it's a human evolutionary path, and all of us will get there sometime, sooner or later. Get where, I'm not sure, because we're not sure. But enough questions? You want more?
Thank you so much, Celine.
I'm very welcome.
And gratitude to you for your teachings. It's lovely to have you here. And for those who are interested to know more about Chan, we do have a book on that, which is available for distribution here, and also the Heart Sutra as well. Actually, this is my very first sutra that I ever came across.
How was it?
Yeah, and I actually learned the Cantonese version by heart.
Oh, good.
And this, when I found this...
Cantonese?
Yeah, because I speak Cantonese. Oh. And then when I first came across this book, it was actually in America, and I was overjoyed when I brought them back to Australia, and then found out, oh, it's actually distribution here.
They're everywhere.
So we've certainly got these at the centre, so if anyone's interested, you can take this. Okay. Just some news in terms of the centre. We've got a lot of upcoming events. This Friday we have Ayeshi coming to